Welcome to Longevity. I'm your host, Natalie Nittam. I'm a nutritionist, a human potential and epigenetic coach, and I created this podcast to bring you the latest ways to take control of your health and longevity. We cover it all, from new technology and ancestral health practices to personalized interventions and a very special interest of mine, peptides and bioregulators. Enjoy the show. Welcome back, folks. I'm Natalie Nittam, your host. I've got a returning guest today whose story honestly never stops blowing my mind. At just 19 years old, she was told she had stage 4 cancer and likely wouldn't make it to the end of the year. Now, instead of accepting that, she went down a completely different path, one that has now shaped how we think about cancer, metabolism, and healing. Today, Dr. Nasha Winters and I unpack what really drives cancer, from metabolic terrain to mindset, and why this isn't about fighting your body, but understanding it. We also get into fasting, ketogenic strategies, and why one-size-fits-all approaches can actually backfire. If you've ever wondered whether there's a more personalized, integrated way to approach health or even a diagnosis, this conversation, which is part one of two, will open your eyes to new possibilities. Next up, I'll thank two sponsors, and then we dive in. Have you ever noticed how aging doesn't show up one day? It just kind of sneaks up on you. One day you're bouncing back quickly, and then it seems like suddenly recover just takes longer. Energy dips a little more, and things don't feel quite as resilient. Now, it's easy to think something broke, but sometimes that's just not really what's happening. What's actually happening is your body's repair systems are slowly losing capacity, especially your stem cells. And that's why I've been incorporating Stem Regen into my routine on a regular basis. It's a simple daily add-in that supports your body's ability to renew and repair from within. Stem Regen is based on the research of stem cell scientist Christian Drapeau and uses specific plant compounds shown to help release your own stem cells from your own bone marrow into your own circulation. This supports repair, recovery, and overall resilience in a really foundational way. Now, if you want to check this out and try it for yourself to support your body before things start to slide, head on over to stemregen.co/nat15 and use code NAT15 on your entire purchase. If you're going to sweeten something, it might as well actually do something good for you. Because most sweeteners, whether it's sugar or some of these healthy alternatives, really don't bring that much to the table aside from sweetness. Now, this is why I tend to use Manucora honey. It's become part of my daily routine, a heap teaspoon in the morning to support immunity and gut health. And then every once in a while, I'll also use it in my tea. I'll drizzle it a little bit over yogurt or even mix a tiny bit into smoothie. It's an easy upgrade that does not feel like a compromise. Now, Manucora is collected by master beekeepers in New Zealand. And the brilliant bees that make it collect their nectar from the Manuka tea tree. This is what gives it those bioactive compounds. You're getting more antioxidants, more prebiotics, and that naturally occurring MGO, which makes this honey completely different from anything else you'll find at the grocery store. Now, if you want to get your hands on some and try it out, which I highly recommend, head on over to manucora.com/nat. That's manucora.com/nat to save up to 31%. Plus, get $25 worth of free gifts with the starter kit, which comes with an MGO 850-plus Manuka honey jar, 5 honey travel sticks, a wooden spoon, and a guidebook on how to use this incredible elixir. So once again, that's manucora.com/nat to save up to 31%, plus get $25 worth of free gifts. Dr. Nasha Winters, welcome back to the show. It is such a pleasure to have you here today.
I adore you, Nat. Thank you for having me back.
It's, folks, we have recorded together before, so I would encourage you. We will put the links to previous episodes in the show notes. But Dr. Nasha is, well, she's just awesome and operates in a space that I think this day and age is critically important. So what I do want to start a little bit. I want to touch a tiny bit on your origin story, because for people who don't know, for the 5 people who might not know who you are and who don't know anything about you, I want to take us back to that day that you heard stage 4 at the age of 19. So what did you actually hear, and what was the decision that you made in that moment?
Wow. So gosh, I still every time I tap into it, it's a strange experience. It's like, oh yeah, hopping back into a body.
I could see it in your face actually. Yeah.
I kind of feel like my life was BC and post, post C. So before cancer, after cancer. And that day was interesting because it had been many months of me trying to get help, coming in every week, every 2 weeks into the ER, like something's wrong. And then just telling me, it's the more of the same. So historically diagnosed with IBS, thyroid dysfunction, juvenile rheumatoid arthritis, PCOS, endometriosis.
So they were just cycling through all the things.
They're like, this is, all the things, all your symptoms fit all the things you've currently been given a label for. And I can understand, kindness to them in 1991, what the reality of my situation was absolutely a unicorn to what would have been walking into their office at that time. So I want to give some, some kindness to those physicians. But that day when I finally ended up in there, my roommate found me unconscious. I was really in trouble, and it was like bad, 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 bad. And then the bottom fell out, and it fell out so fast that I was even unaware of what was happening in my body until I was in the emergency room yet again, and a different doctor on call took one look at me and realized this woman is not dealing with any of those layers. She is not drug seeking. She is not histrionic. She is, something's wrong here. And fast forward, when he came in to give me the news about 7 hours later into workups, imaging, blood draws, all the things, he was crying because he had a 19-year-old daughter. And when he came in, he could barely get the words out to say, we don't have the definitive. It'll take us a few weeks to get the final biopsy results, but it's clear that you have cancer. We assume by the looks of the imaging that it starts in your pelvic region, in your ovary, and that you're at the end of the line, like you are end stage. At that time I had a complete bowel blockage. I had lesions all over my liver. My belly was filled with fluid. I looked like I was pregnant, but sloshing pregnant. I was extremely cachectic, so extreme muscle wasting. So little tiny arms, little tiny legs, but a big, huge belly. My ureter was being pushed off. My kidney was being compressed with the tumor on my right ovary. And I had just a blanketing, they explained, of these peritoneal implants, or this carcinomatosis, which is like a shrapnel of tumor all throughout my pelvis. I had fluid in my lungs. I had fluid around my heart. I was in trouble. I was in trouble, let's put it mildly. And so I was in such trouble that in a few weeks before my 20th birthday in 1991, they didn't expect me to see the end of the year of 1991. That's what they told me. And they said that a single dose of chemotherapy would outright kill me because I just had failed liver, blockage, the whole bit. So that moment was shocking, to put it mildly. I've told this story a little bit. Maybe you and I've even talked about it. There was a moment, a very, very brief moment of relief. And this will sound like part of it was knowing what you know.
It's kind of like, I'm not crazy, right?
Exactly. So it's like, no, I'm not crazy. But then there was also this relief because, truth be told, I had come from a really difficult upbringing and never really saw a future for myself, but kept trying. And for me, I'd actually tried to take my life on a few occasions in earlier years. And there was this moment that was like, well, this is a much sexier way to go. Like there was like a moment of,
holy geez,
right? Yeah. It was like, this is a little better than doing it myself. Like, it just, that was like this moment. But then this other thing clicked in, which it was also part of my, so I love the concept of parts, internal system. So one part of me was like, yay, I get to go. And the other part was, yay, someone understands me, finally sees me. And the third part was, don't tell me what to do, which was the part that came forward, which was like the double dog dare part. And so even though I was told there was nothing to do, I had no illusion that I was going to fix it, heal it, win it, fight it. I just wanted to understand it. And now that has been 34 plus years now later, that is still all I care about, is I want to understand why for myself and for the tens of thousands of patients I've worked with directly and the hundreds of thousands I've worked with indirectly. I want to understand why. And that's what brings us here today.
I love it. I honestly love it. And I love this concept of many truths can be true at the same time. You can have multiple realities, honor them, accept them, and lean into the one that's going to serve you.
That gives me chills.
Yeah. Right? That's the decision you made. So what was the, what would you say is the first medical certainty that you question? And what did it cost you? What was the cost socially and professionally to question it? Because that would have been down the road, right?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, for sure. So weirdly, so in those first few months, I was really, really, really on my own. There was no doctor.
When you left the doctor, so what did you do? I mean, because you're 19 years old, right. You're a baby.
Yeah.
And yeah. And this guy's just explained to you, weeping with compassion and empathy, I'm so incredibly sorry. This is your path.
Yeah. I don't know how I even knew to do that as a sophomore in college, but I did. That was like on a Friday of like a few days later, I had my second opinion, which was no different than the first opinion. What they did that day in the hospital was make me comfortable. They drained the fluid. I had to come back every few days to have it drained. They offered me pain medication, which I tried in the beginning, but it made me even sicker. And throwing up with the blockage is one of the most painful things you can ever imagine. So instead, what made me more comfortable is just having the drain and just accidentally being forced into a fast, which is also probably what, in retrospect, saved my life. We can talk about that here in a moment. Mm-hmm. But that second opinion on Monday was more the same. But they added another layer, which was, and you don't have insurance, so you're kind of fucked. You know, I'm like,
oh,
perfect. Awesome. Like that was, and so it was like a weird thing. Like you're screwed. And even if you had resources, you know, and if you
also you're screwed.
Options, you're screwed. So I'm like, yeah. All right. That was the day that sent me looking down the rabbit hole of other options, which in this day and age, I almost hate to say this name out loud, but at the time, back then, this person's work and book saved my life, which was a book called Quantum Healing by little shade character these days, Deepak Chopra, which bums me out because he was such an integral part of what shifted my understanding of myself and what is possible was that book. And so I believe you can also love the message and not the messenger. And so just planting that seed for a moment as we're having a lot of controversial discussions about people right now.
Well, and I think we don't have to throw away the good with the bad necessarily.
You know what I mean?
There's parts. Humans by definition are complex.
And flawed.
And inherently flawed. And God knows if we've learned anything over the last number of years, and certainly in the last few months, there's a lot of warts out there on all the fancy people. They have them just like everybody else. Yeah. So anyway, so let's, you know, so, at the time,
so that was very helpful. So let's then fast forward. We're a few months into this. So my first big, like something's wrong with the universe is that early 1992, it's in the first few months of 1992, I'm still here. I'm no longer needing to get drained every couple of days at that. It extended out to every couple of weeks. I don't eat for 2.5 months. So I'm not taking anything solid for 2.5 months. And in fact, the first bit I could only manage maybe the first month or 6 weeks, only sips of water. And then I was able to expand it into more herbal teas and things like that. So for 2.5 months, I fasted. And that was by accident. But by doing that, I also resolved that bowel blockage. I helped extremely lower massive inflammation that I had been living with for the first 20 years of my life. Now I'm 20 years old. I was like, my rheumatoid arthritis symptoms were gone. My endometriosis symptoms were gone. My IBS symptoms were gone. Like accidentally in the sickest phase of my life, I am feeling better than I'd felt in a decade. Which is super weird to like think about those realities happening at once. So I'm also like, well, now what are we going to do? So I basically go back to the doctor who I got the second opinion.
Oh, not funny, but yes.
Because I'm like, I'm here now. What?
Hi, still here.
Seriously, here's the weirdest thing that happened in the beginning. They did not know what to do with me and they did not want to have anything to do with me. They didn't know what to do and they didn't want to do. I was shooed out of that space so fast,
because that is so fascinating.
I couldn't be understood. Like I did not fit their model of reality.
Yeah.
So there was that piece. And then there was the piece that started being thrown at me. Perhaps you were misdiagnosed. That was a fun one. I dealt with that for the next decade. Literally,
who knew this would be a comedy episode? Yeah,
I know, right? But it was, you know, like it was not very funny then. But I can look back, like for the next decade, I literally had to like take my proof with me everywhere I went to have people look at me and talk to me. And I was also uninsured. So I was afraid to have my diagnosis written anywhere for fear of never being able to get insured. So I would take my records to just say, here's my history, do a thorough workup. This is what I need. So I started trying to guide my own care early on. Mm-hmm. And I was resisted because I didn't fit the model. And I was still an uninsured person. And they didn't have any explanation for where I was, except for just to write me off or to pretend that it never happened. So I got really quiet. Nat, I got really quiet for the next years. In fact, I got so quiet when I applied to medical school, I didn't tell them my history because I was afraid they wouldn't let me in. There were only a handful of people in my life who knew what was I was going through, including the man I'm married to today. He was weirdly not afraid because he had a brother who was diagnosed when he was 16 years old with end-stage pancreatic cancer, sent home to die. And Bob lived another 24 years with an inoperable stage 4 pancreatic cancer. And Steve's sister, shortly after, diagnosed with stage 4 ovarian cancer, still here today. Like, so Steve had a story mm-hmm. that said, that's not a death sentence. That's not my reality. I can choose a different reality. So I happened to bring a partner into my life who could walk a different experience and reality with me.
Wow.
And basically buffer out and roadblock out any belief systems that were contrary to that. You know, so that's what I had to work very hard on, was allowing belief systems into my space. So it was easier for me not to talk about it. In fact, my story did not really become public until 2012.
Wow.
So I carried that for 21 years quietly in a very intimate way, with a lot of very close comrades and a few doctors who guided me along the journey and were like, I have no idea how to explain this, but holy shit, it's fascinating. And I'm all along for the ride. And so that's what along the way, because I didn't have the interventions of standard of care, I was left to my own devices. So I had to keep exploring. And Nat, that's what brings us to a lot of our discussions today, is I started learning about these concepts that didn't fit what I was being taught in my pre-med courses, or even in my first years of medical school, which was maybe germ theory doesn't have all the answers, or maybe the genetic theory or at that time, the two-hit theory of cancer is not really covering all the bases. Like, something's missing in these conversations. And I started stumbling across the work of Beauchamp. I started running across the work of Dr. Otto Warburg. I started running across the work of more modern researchers like Dr. Mina Bissell, who coined the concept of extracellular matrix. Mm-hmm. I ran across the work of an unknown. It would still be 2011 before he became known. I ran across the work of an early adopter of the concept of epigenetics and a molecular biologist by the name of Bruce Lipton.
His
research. That guy. Right, that guy. Yeah. And I ran across the work of Robert Ader and later Candace Pert, which took my pre-med of chemistry and biology into a switcheroo of psychology and biology, and a pre-med or pre-construction of what was a psychoneuroimmunology undergraduate education, which my professors had no idea anything about it, but they were willing, because I was bright and compelling, they were willing to allow me to self-construct a major of things that I was learning. And they didn't know. I wasn't telling them what was going on with me. Only one of my professors knew. But it was just a really wild time of basically like, I'm going to dig my own path because no one else is doing it for me.
That is unbelievable. That is a crazy, crazy story. And I just want to stop for a second and provide some context for someone who might be listening to this, who is living with a diagnosis right now, because I think it's important to say that we're not suggesting that they run out and start fasting for the next 3 months.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, I do want to, you know what I mean? Like, I don't know why I feel very strongly compelled to, and because I know I've heard you say this yourself.
Yeah.
Like, we're now much further down the road. There's a world where conventional care can work with not conventional care. Yeah. I just want to say that. I mean, this is an extraordinary story. And it reminds me of a book that I once read called Radical Remission, which is a series of stories similar to yours,
right? Yep.
Which is these cases that, frankly, doctors stuff them in a drawer somewhere, most doctors. But yet there's the curious guys, right? There's the guys that, wait a minute, what about those, yeah. right? Yeah. So I just want to, for the audience who are listening to this, who are living an experience themselves, what I hope they take from it, and then I'd love you to yes. enrich on that, is a sense of hope and a sense of agency and the power to question, but not to just step away from whatever you're doing right now, because there's more to it than just one thing. So Nisha, maybe you could say it a little differently than me, or you want to add something to that. But
Marshall, that's really well said. And part of my reason for my silence in all those years was because of being completely dismissed. The mm-hmm. second reason is once I started in practice, so started in clinical training practice and then later in my private practice, I didn't want to treat cancer. I didn't want it anywhere near me. And yet,
yeah,
there you are. Plan. By 2012, I had to shut down my private, my 2,500 patient, family practice to just focus on oncology because I could not keep up with the demand. And I had a year-long wait list and people were literally dying in my waiting room. And I was like, so I focused, right? But that took me years. I was of like trying to deny what God
the universe is like. Actually, you have a job.
It's like we did that for you, so you could do this for other people. It's like So back to that place here. This is also why I don't know. Maybe it's because I'm a Libra or what, but I am so much a team player.
Yes. Right?
And so for me, in my experience at that time with no resources, remember there's no Dr. Google, there's no podcast like this, there's no understanding of a possibility of an integrative approach. Mm-hmm. I had to go it alone and there was no offering from standard of care, which is why I ended up in that boat. But because I was accidentally, nothing was intentional or expected, getting better, I got more curious and dug deeper. And over all these years, I've learned mechanisms of action of some of the things I accidentally did that also happen in certain pharmaceutical interventions or off-label interventions or other even natural interventions. So I've been able to kind of do a retrospective to understand why things worked accidentally the way they did. And so I want you to know who I am today. Because also back in 1991, we didn't have choices for somebody like me. It was like, this is the only treatment. You're still likely going to die. They told me I would. 3 months in, if we could give you a treatment, you're still dead in 3 months. Like, so it didn't look good for anybody at that time, right?
Yeah.
Today, we've come a long way. There are a lot of different ways to approach this. There's a lot of new testing, and we're going to dive into that here in a minute, that tells us what is the best fit from standard of care, but also what is the best fit from quote unquote alternative care that could meet you in this moment.
Yeah.
And that's the key. There's no one target. There's no one treatment. There's no one way. And there's also moment by moment. What my body needed at that early stage in late 1991, early 1992 was different than what my body needed in 1995 and 96. And later a decade, 2009 and different places where this kind of brought its head up to be like, hi, I needed to
hear.
Exactly. But also I knew there were new things to do. Like I kind of feel like I kicked the can down the road long enough to learn something new. So to your point, I believe that we can bring the best of both worlds together in a very N of one precise and personalized approach. That is here today for all of us. And the rate limiting factor of that are not enough people trained in it and not enough financial resources, because to do what I'm talking about doing requires you to leave a medical system, whether it's a national healthcare system like in Canada or the UK or an insurance model in the United States, which is unfortunate because it's these approaches that actually lower the cost of standard of care, lower the time, lower the duration, lower the side effects.
And
the cost of these other therapies are far, far less. So it actually is a model that would sustain our medical system financially, but we're not there yet.
Yeah. Well, but I know that for me, when I'd read a paper at some point that said people who fast for 24 hours before going into a chemo treatment have fewer side effects. The chemo is more effective. And I mean, this may vary from cancer to cancer. I'm not making a blanket statement, but generally speaking, there was a good amount of clinical evidence that said that, you know, the healthy cells will turn inwards to protect themselves. The cancer cells are perpetually hungry. I mean, this is a gross oversimplification, but cancer cells are perpetually looking for nutrients. And so therefore, by fasting for 24 hours going in, you encourage the healthy cells to protect themselves. The cancer cells are looking for food. The chemo is more effective against the cancer cells. Yeah. And then sometimes people don't lose their hair. They have fewer side effects. I have yet to get through to convince one single person to do that.
What?
And not that I talk to people with cancer much, but and I think part of the problem is that their clinicians are saying, you need nutrition.
Right.
You're losing weight. You can't lose too much weight. And I'm like, it's 24 hours. It's one day. It's one day, dinner to dinner. Anyway, the point being that, you know, there's still a lot of opposition in the system. So, okay, let's get back on track to our scaffolding here, because although this is all fascinating anyway. So at what point did you stop thinking about cancer as a fight and start thinking about cancer as information? This is information.
You know, this is where
you remember?
I do. I think it was the very day I was diagnosed, which I think flips people out. And I think it's what set a very different tone and pace for me, because in 1991, we claimed the war on cancer in 1971. So we were 20 years in on this experiment. And we called it the war on cancer because in 1971, that's what we collectively understood as a culture. You know, this is the tail end.
How are we going to do this?
War. Yeah. Exactly. And so it was something we could all kind of get behind, right? Yeah. Well, that didn't pan out. Still hasn't panned out, by the way, the kind of warring, battling concept or the fuck cancer concept, which I know a lot of people derive power in that, and good on them, but I'm inviting people to think about this differently. I'm inviting people to say, maybe, you know, these cells are me. There was some shift that happened. Maybe waging war on myself isn't the best message I want to give to the whole organism here.
Maybe.
Right. Yeah. And or maybe we can do, like we talked about the parallel realities earlier. Mm-hmm. How can I both, and we talked about this even before the recording, how can I support the healthy while still targeting what has forgotten who it was?
You know? How can
you do that? And that's what I feel like I get to do in this world. I wanted to say something that you said that was so compelling. It's going to take me a second just to grab back onto it. I think it might be gone. That's okay. It'll come full circle here. But that's the piece. Oh, the grappling with like all the weird, what were your first moments of knowing that, again, the fact that people just didn't believe me because I was so out of their paradigm. It was just too much. You also mentioned radical remission. Dr. Kelly Turner, who's also become a friend, she wrote the foreword to my book, The Metabolic Approach to Cancer. I've co-taught workshops with her, and many of the stories in her follow-up book were patients I cared for. So I love that of showing there is absolutely another way. But that's what you talked about is she showed that there are these miracles all around us all the time, that there's these spontaneous healings around us all the time. She got curious because nobody else was. And she, over a decade, looked at and found these 1,000 people that had recorded radical healings and looked into the common denominators.
That was the most fascinating part to me, because it wasn't a supplement. It wasn't a food. Right. There were 9 of them, right?
9. And in her follow-up book, she brought in a 10th, which is exercise.
Oh, cool. Okay.
Yeah. But you're right. So there were, she says, diet, supplements, exercise, these tangibles, they matter, but it's not about a specific nutrient or a specific herb or a specific diet. It's about a change in diet or a change in the routine. That's what was most compelling. But the other 7 factors are all an inside job.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And that's what was so compelling. So when you ask about my moment was something in me knew that day when that man was crying, basically in my arms, not the other way around.
Oh my God, that's hilarious.
I know. Sorry.
It's okay. It's going to be fine.
My life, it's such a funny thing. Was this moment of like, I am not going to battle this because I don't know what I'm battling. So I need to understand it. And that's how my journey really began and where it continues to go. because the way we approach it today, we battle it without discernment. And so therefore we take out the good with the bad.
Yeah. We can collateral damage.
Right. We can be discerning today in a way we couldn't be 34 years ago, even 10 years ago. So I think that is really exciting. And some of the other messages you talked about, the food piece. Mm-hmm. We've got Dr. Mureshi in 1909 was treating his cancer patients simply by fasting them. And fasting them alone was minimizing, diminishing, shrinking the tumors with no other input.
But that's amazing. And what we know makes sense, right? This whole concept of autophagy and apoptosis.
And it's even more than that. When we look at the hallmarks of cancer, all the different doorways into what makes cancer, cancer.
Yeah.
Fasting impacts every one of those doorways. Right. And it's really interesting to me because we actually were actively encouraging through the nursing and physicians through the 1960s as fasting as a general support for many conditions. And somewhere someone got an idea in their head that, oh, that's a bad idea. Don't make
snack
suffer anymore. Right. No matter what you do, don't lose weight. Well, maybe that made sense to say that in 1960. But today, when 70% of us are obese, you can use a few pounds, right? And especially, even more importantly, lose a few pounds that are wrapped around your organs that you're not seeing. Even if you look the right package on the outside, you may still be a little fatty on the inside. And that's what's even more toxic and dangerous to be dealt with. And then you spoke to having a difficulty getting your friends or colleagues to do a 24 water fast. Dr. Walter Longo, I first heard him 16, 17, maybe longer years ago, before Prolon, before his books, before his research became famous, he was putting all of his patients on a 5-day fast around chemo. So 2 days before, day of, 2 days after. And I started employing that with all of my patients the second I started hearing that from him, because I'd already been doing it for myself, but it's like I got permission
from
a researcher that it was a little more compelling and I could show the data and not get so much fight back, even though I would whisper to my patients, you might do this. To your point, many were resistant. But once I had the data to go, look, there's something to this, and start sharing a little bit more about my own fasting process, people got into it. I don't have a problem compelling people to do this anymore. Especially just last year, Dr. Walter Longo's book, Fasting Cancer, came out, which is the whole compendium. It's huge. It's like all the research. To me, at this point, and now you even said, I'm not sure if it's appropriate for all cancers. It's appropriate for anybody doing chemotherapy, anybody doing immune therapy, anybody doing targeted therapy, no matter the cancer type, no matter if it's a solid or a blood cancer, no matter it's a pre-cancer process. What he is able to show and what I've seen clinically in thousands of patients is if they're getting chemo like every 3 to 4 weeks, I'm definitely doing the 5-day process, the 2 days before, day of, 2 days after. If they're having to be on a chemo that's daily, or excuse me, weekly, I might do 16 hours before the day of and 16 hours after. It's like a more consolidated. Right. If they're doing a daily oral agent, for instance, then I have them basically do a long, a very narrow window eating diet. So basically they're on a 16 age or a 24 eating window. And we take the medication at the most fasted part of the equation. Right. So there's ways to do this in any of those. To me, that should be standard of care. Standard and we should be training nutritionists on how to safely facilitate patients through this process. Because to your point, the studies are unbelievable of how much better these patients feel and get through treatment more in a timely fashion than those who eat ad libitum. And the other thing is, yes, you'll lose weight, but these patients who fast normalize their weight faster than those who don't. That should be compelling to our medical providers out there. So those are some of the big flaming hoops we're up against. You hit them is ideology, food as medicine or lack of food as medicine, and the way that we can be much, much, much more precise today. And there's no excuse that everybody doesn't get access to a very precise path forward.
Wow. Yeah. Well, that's wild. Okay. Let's talk about the concept of terrain. When did that come up? Because, it's all about the tumor, We become fixated on that thing. And at some point you kind of wait a minute.
Yeah.
Where is it? What's the environment it's in? And so when did that really come to you, and how, in some ways?
somewhere towards the end of 1992 or early part of 1993. I was deeper now. I was like in my junior year of college, all of my pre-meds, you know, I was in my physiologies and my anatomies, zoologies, like all biochemistries, all of the classes. And of course, in the background, I was studying cancer, right? I wanted to understand it. I had a Pell Grant, so to have work study in the library. So that's how I helped pay for my education. So it was a time when they didn't have cameras in the library. I was basically homeless, sleeping in a couch in the library, showering in the gym, and staying up all night reading. Not great for my circadian rhythm.
Please, Nisha.
So, wow. I'm the only person in my family to go to college, so you got to do what you got to do. And I was working several jobs, you know, and I worked grave shifts as a detox count. Like, I understand now, I probably would have stabilized this much faster had I not been working graveyard shifts the first two or three years of my diagnosis. Mm-hmm. That we, of course, learned later, but that was a big, big player. But I learned a lot in those.
Well, and you did what you had to do, sister.
You did. That's exactly it. And so we talked about that before this recording too. You do what you have to do and then you clean up after, right?
Yeah.
So I started learning when I mentioned Beauchamp, I was reading about, of course, I mean, I was being taught germ theory and all these different things in my pre-med, but I started stumbling across the work of Beauchamp and others of that same era that were talking about the concept of terrain. That's what they talked about. They talked about, you know, that you could take a cancer cell and put it in a certain medium and nothing would happen. Or you could take a cancer cell and put it in another medium and it will grow like a mofo, right? So that was really like stood out to me. Well, what's in the medium? Like, where is that? That's also when I started running across the work of Dr. Mina Bissell, who was a cancer researcher in the 1980s, still, by the way, she's now 40 some years into her own cancer research, who's still, here's someone who's diminished in her brilliance, which there was a great TED talk that she did many years ago, probably 15 years ago now. Look her up. She's Bissell, like the vacuum cleaner.
Yeah.
I wrote it down. Research, and it talks about this extracellular matrix, which she's literally saying while she's in the research lab, noticing why cancer cells are growing in some petri dishes and not in others. And I'm thinking, whoa, here's a leap of something we were talking about in the 1800s. You know, 17 and 1800s, now being talked about in the 1980s and 90s, why is no one looking at this? And that really stuck with me. And then I started learning more about, because I did start to have an understanding in my first abnormal psych class with Dr. Tom Skirky, that the trauma of my childhood and the experiences I had definitely had a change. And that's what really started, going down the rabbit hole of psychoneuroimmunology, having someone explain to me, I have a brother who's a diagnosed sociopath and a restraining order against him all these years. Like, I can't believe I'm telling you this story, but I'm telling you the story in that it was not a safe place to grow up. And it's in some ways not a safe place to be on the planet, not knowing where he is or what he's up to. So my body had to be hypervigilant at a young age for survival. That is all cancer is a hypervigilance, doing the best it can to survive and find resources to live, right? And so when I learned that there's other ways to create nourishment, other ways to create safety, other ways to understand, quote unquote, the enemy inside me and outside me, it shifted the way my body could actually respond to whatever therapy it was being given. So wow. I'm telling you my side of it, but that's where patients who might be more drawn to doing chemotherapy alone, your mindset's still going to matter. Mm-hmm. Your experience, your safety in this world, in this body, is still going to matter how well you receive that medicine. Or the person on the other side who's like, I'm not doing those poisons. I'm just going to do alternative. Same idea. Like, the medicine matters less than the environment it's landing in. And that's what terrain theory is all about. It's about what was the environment? What were the circumstances that allowed for health or allowed for dis-ease? Mm-hmm. Let's explore the individuality of it all, because all of us have a various sort of set of code, a blueprint, our epigenetics that we come in with. We have certain ways that we respond to the environment in, on, and around us. And we have to understand that for each person and be able to then support them to make the right changes or the right awarenesses to change the way their field is responding or reacting to whatever yeah. it is they're putting in on and around them.
I mean, that's so important that you brought in the psychoneuroimmunology, right? The state of mind, yeah. your beliefs, mm-hmm. the, you know, that whole piece of it, because yeah, how you nourish your body, yeah. how you, the people around you, and this is part of Dr. Turner's work, like yeah. the people around you, is your job a toxic job? Do you have community? You know, are you giving your body the right fuel, all the things? But that early, and it goes back to ACE, right? Or early childhood
yes.
adverse events. And it's, and I actually recently interviewed the Amy Apigian, who just wrote The Biology of Trauma.
Oh,
and the way that she explains, and I'm sure you resonate with her work as well, explaining your childhood, like your body is trying to keep you alive and safe at all times. And so a child, and the other thing that, so there's two things that she talks about that I find so fascinating. So as a child, your brain or your subconscious yeah. learns we need to be within these guardrails right. to be safe, right? And that's your capacity for dealing with stress and what you interpret as trauma, which the next guy, this is the other big idea that I got out of her book, was the thing that you interpret as a life-threatening event, dude over here didn't have the same experience as you. Yeah. It just rolls off his back, right? So, and it's not that he's better than you. He just lived a different experience and interpreted the information differently. So I love that you brought up that piece because, yes, it's all the material, physical things. But and I think that in the Radical Remission book, probably – that's the piece that made the difference for every one of those people is yes. Ooh, figuring out somehow tapping into how to address that. Even if they stumbled upon it, you did.
Yeah.
Full on. Like you fell into it. Yeah. So, okay. So another question for you, and I'm laughing because, you know, I have this scaffold for the episode. We haven't moved off the first section. So I just want you to know that we're going to have a part two.
There you
this,
go.
Just so you know, like I'm hoping what people take away from this is inspiration. Right?
Yeah.
It's belief. It's a breath of fresh air. It's knowledge and understanding. So it sounds, you know, sometimes like so far on this conversation, everybody's sitting there going, oh my God, this is amazing. You know, she just did this and then she did this and that worked and this worked and that worked and it was amazing. And it was what? No bumps in the road. And we both know, yeah, no, maybe not so much. So there's anything that you did, are there things that you did that actually didn't work? And how do you keep your patients from repeating those same mistakes?
Well,
other than just saying, oh, don't do that. It's not going to work.
Well, I did because the only information back in 1991 from a few books in my library and that I stumbled across were things like the Gerson therapy.
Yeah.
But I found it was the original works of the 1940s and 50s works. Things like Hoxie formula, Essiac tea. Mm-hmm. You'll still see these make the rounds on the internet. So I kind of tried all the things, right? For me, they all backfired horribly. And I didn't know until many years later, for instance, many of the herbs, say in the Hoxie and the Essiac, are very pro-estrogenic.
Oops.
I had a very estrogen dominant process happening in my body. Mm-hmm. And I just added insult to injury. Okay. Sure. So for me, that was my backup. The other thing I was reading about was laetril and apricot seeds and the whole bitch. So I was eating gallons. I almost gave myself arsenic poisoning. Like I learned the way. So things that I've learned about those, for instance, is that those therapies, some of those older therapies were designed at a time and a place that we were on a very different planet with very different terrains. Mm-hmm. So like the Budwig diet, the original Gerson diet, these were all pre-World War II.
Okay.
Or just shortly after. This is before we had plastics. This is before we had EMFs. This is before we had hormones like fed into our animal systems. And this is before we had massive swaths of antibiotics given to all of our animals as well. This is before we had glyphosate and organopesticides, all the things that we started dumping on our soil post-World War II. This is a time where our bodies were very different and a little bit of nourishment went a long way. This is also at a time
so
when we had 50% reduction of minerals in our soil, et cetera. So context is everything. So when we read those things and we think that's how it's done, you may fall really short of that, or you are now in a different body and a different environment than those things were originally designed for. So perhaps Hoxie was really great when we weren't swimming in estrogen endocrine disrupting swimming pools of life, you know? Same thing with like Laetril. I've seen it work really well in IV forms in certain blood cancers, but I've personally in all my years never seen it do much. And I have a lot of friends and colleagues who have tried it or seen it, but it has not panned out in the patient population I've served, nor my colleagues' patient populations they've served. So it's more popular than not. There's also a very powerful concept known as placebo, right?
Yeah.
If you, and I don't know why we downplay it, because many studies show that placebo is far more powerful than the treatment at hand. So if you're taking something that you believe is helping you, it's probably helping you to some degree. Yeah. But there are also the opposite. There are things that you can take that you believe are helping you that can actually cause harm. So for instance, a really good example, green tea. When green tea, all the research has come about green tea in the, you know, the late 1990s, early 2000s, everyone and their dog was like, you need the Genmatcha form. You need 100, you know, you need 10 cups a day of this. I went to town on green tea. Like I was drinking sweat. I was spending like $60 an ounce, like to get the best of the best, the highest catechins and all the things. TMI, but my boobs went from a heavy A cup into like a C cup overnight. And I had no idea why. I had no idea until somewhere in the mid to late 2006 to eight zone, I learned that I have three homozygous calm tea snips. Catecholamine snips, which means things like quercetin, which everyone thinks is the cat's meow, and green tea, which is everyone's go-to in the cancer space, would actually back up stress hormone and estrogen metabolism in my body. So for slow calm tea patients, this is where I learned along the way, guys. I was the first laboratory, and then I'd apply it to patients. That's when I started learning slow calm tea patients should not be taking these medicines. Right? That we call these the panacea, catch-all, end-all, be-all of cancer care, backfired tremendously, right? So these are the types of things I had to figure out for myself. And then it started to point out the biochemical individuality of those people that I served. So things that I thought would be a really good idea. So things like Rife machines, fascinating. We're getting into the world of energy medicine. They absolutely have a time and a place. But if you are not absolutely clear, well-educated, and well-understanding of the frequencies of health and disease, and specifically the polarities of the patient you're working with, you can actually make those therapies make the cancer grow. And I've seen that, unfortunately, more often than the opposite to be true. So I have an original Rife machine, right? I was trying that on things. Not a good idea. I didn't know. So I was just playing with it. It's like today, all the things on red light. If you're taking red light therapy over a part of your body and that you're not also doing photosensitizers and oxygen with it, you actually could be supporting the cancer or even proliferating it versus treating it. But if it's done with a sensitizing agent and an oxygen therapy to potentize it, then that same red light therapy can act like a cancer treatment.
But what's the sensitizing agent?
Things like, so for instance, methylene blue.
Like methylene. I was hoping you were. Yeah.
Yeah. That's so, but again, you got to have the right G6PD to use a methylene blue.
Yeah.
You can't have any serotonin issues in your chemistry. No. Or you could hurt yourself, but everyone and their dog can get on methylene blue now. So,
I know.
So this is where you could take it. You wait anywhere from 7 to 9 hours, and then you take a shot of ozone or, you know, an insufflation or an inhaled or an HBOT to potentize it, to sort of activate the methylene blue that gets taken up into cells that are deranged in their metabolism. So that might be an infection, that might be a cancerous process. And then you apply the right red light. Now, methylene blue and red light have a particular affinity for each other, but there's others.
They love each other.
Yeah, they love each other. But there's others like curcumin and yellow light. Like there's other things that they have a partnership of sensitizing agents and light as well. This is why we eat quality, real food. I'm not against folks like being fully carnivore or whatnot, but I do understand the power of the photosensitizing agents of plants, and that I'm going to eat my plant-dense food and go out and in the sun every day and have that interact and get my oxygen up by, you know, doing some exercise and get all those things. Like I can do these things on myself, right? Well, to enhance. But those are the things that we've learned a little bit that can almost sometimes get us in trouble mm-hmm. or we can minimize the benefit of things that can actually be very, very helpful.
If you've been a regular listener to this podcast for the past few years, you're already in the know. But if you're one of our newer listeners, you may have noticed something. Bioregulators, a little bit new out on the market, and they are growing in leaps and bounds in popularity. And here's why. Think of bioregulators as drivers of cellular renewal in your body at a tissue, organ, and system level. As we go through life, DNA gets damaged, so our signals at a genetic level starts to fade. The bioregulator peptides actually can get to that DNA and either repair the signals or essentially give the DNA instruction to start production of proteins that maybe it wasn't producing as much of as you used to when you were younger. And so we get that upregulated cellular renewal. They do this quietly, subtly, and in the background. The renewal starts happening in ways that only your body knows how to execute. Paired with lifestyle and nutrition, these tiny molecules can make all the difference in how we age. Now, here's my approach at this time of year. As days get longer and schedules start to shift, I really love to do a cycle of foundational tune-up stack from Nature's Marvels. I'll do the pineal gland for circadian rhythm refresh, the thymus gland for immune reboot, and blood vessel bioregulator to help to clean up the highways to and from the cells. This is a beautiful stack to repeat once or twice a year. Now you can find Nature's Marvels bioregulators at profoundhealth.com and use code NAT1515 for 15% off your order. I love that you brought in the genetics because that's not even particularly sophisticated genetics.
No, it's
right. Basic. You can get that from any test.
Exactly.
And it's just that there's so little understanding about it that it's being ignored. And we hope that the physician of the future starts to look at these things and say, oh, look, we can tell from here that you're going to process anesthesia a lot faster than the next guy. So you're going to need more. Whereas you over here, we're going to give you baby amounts because otherwise we're going to keep you under for way too long.
Exactly.
So, I mean, this is known.
Yeah.
This is known information. It just hasn't quite
mainstreamed yet. Yeah.
Mainstream. Yeah. So you talk about diet, which it's a pet thing of mine. Yeah. And interestingly enough, there was a woman in my life years ago who had a very aggressive breast mm-hmm. cancer, and she went fully natural, hardcore keto, and she looked phenomenal. And she died in the end.
Yeah.
And she believed in every cell of her body, this was the thing that was going to save her life. And she went to Mexico and had some crazy alternative treatment.
Right.
I want to talk about keto a little bit because there is a narrative that the keto diet will save you,
right?
If you have cancer.
Yeah.
And can we talk about keto?
Yes.
Please.
So ketogenic diet is a diet that is high fat, somewhere from 70 to 95% of the diet being fat, depending on a 2-to-1, 1-to-1, whatever ratio, and a moderate to low protein and a very diminished carbohydrate. You typically
like really low.
Really low, 20%.
You can barely eat lettuce.
Yeah, 20 grams, under 20% of it being fat. So yeah, above the ground, leafy greens, things like that, fine. But anything above starts to get, you know, carb count. So that is a very therapeutic diet that was utilized in the 1920s for children with epilepsy, worked far better than any pharmaceutical out there that would later come to the market in the 40s. Depakote then pushed the diet off the table, despite the fact that it's still more effective than the pill. So we know it can absolutely do amazing things for brain chemistry at that high fat, low carb area. It got really picked up in the world of brain tumors. Very, very helpful in primary brain tumors, specifically glioblastomas, where the research has been done. And it's very potentized with other metabolic therapies like hyperbaric oxygen, for instance, mm-hmm. some off-label drugs or other things that may block things like glutamine as well. So that's a whole nother piece. There is an absolute volume of favorable data, and I have thousands of patients who have successfully used a high-fat, low-carb ketogenic diet in the treatment of cancer. But we also knew it was not the standalone. And we also knew that it needed to be layered and timing mattered, and that people needed to test. Because I will tell you, your friend, I put money down that she was never testing her ketones.
Well, she was pretty hardcore.
She was. Okay, good.
I will say that she was pretty hardcore. But I have a question for you. Okay. I have read somewhere that there are certain types of tumors that can feed on ketones.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so you're getting to that. Good, because the narrative is sugar feeds cancer and ketones don't.
So a couple things. So on that, if you're going to be using a therapeutic ketogenic diet for anything, whether it's
and you do need to measure,
whether it's, you have to test, you have to have a blood glucose monitor. My favorite is Ketomojo because they've undercut the cost of strips dramatically. And they just do good things in the world. They have a foundation. Mm-hmm. They do fund a lot of research, et cetera. So I don't get anything for saying that. They're just people that I love their hearts and I love what they bring to the world, but you have to test, you have to know what you're dealing with. But to your point, what happened is even when my book came out in 2017, I didn't want the word ketogenic diet or the phrase on my book, but the SEO, the publishing company, put it up there because I'm like, I'm going to be pegged as the ketogenic lady, which I did. I got pegged of that. What I am is the metabolic flexibility lady.
Mm-hmm.
And
love
what
that.
I am is the right diet for the right person at the right time, the right dose, duration, combination, the right stacks, et cetera. And the epigenetics matter. And the tumor type matters, and the stage matters, and the timing matters. So all of these pieces are really integral. What people unfortunately screw up is that ketone bodies are very different than a ketogenic diet. Ketone mm-hmm. bodies are made from a ketogenic diet, but that's one road to Rome, right? So for me, there are many cancer types. Well, I will not use a high fat, low carb diet, but I still want them in ketosis.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's where we look at ketone bodies themselves are just signaling agents.
Yeah.
You can get into ketosis by intermittent fasting, so time restricted eating. You can get into ketosis with deeper, longer term fasting. You can get into ketosis with exogenous ketones. You can get into ketosis on a carnivore diet. You can get into ketosis on a vegetarian diet. You can get into ketosis with just a strongly carb restricted and not changing of the fat intake. I believe that that's one place that gets really confused and bastardized out there is the underestimation of the power of ketone bodies as signaling agents.
Yeah.
In a few studies that have come up, Dr. Eric Berg, who's also become a friend of mine, like he's looked at some of the studies about a couple of pathways that do show that there are a few cancers that can, and again, these are all in, they're not in clinical trials. These are in environments of laboratory, not like cell line studies.
Okay.
But there are certain tumor cell lines that can utilize ketone bodies as a fuel source. But as someone who's been in practice for as long as I have and seen this, I would still say, well, first of all, I would say 100% of all cancers diagnosed need to be carb restricted, period. That is, okay. I don't think anybody would argue that anymore. And that might be that you just need to get it down below 75 grams in some, under 50 grams in others, and others under 20 grams, right?
Okay.
That's a very, the amount of fat is going to be very individual to the situation. Like for therapeutic ketosis for a brain tumor, that makes sense to go super high fat, low carb. But certain breast tumors, now here's what's cool. We can actually even test today. We can test for things like KRAS. Like KRAS mutations, you are underserving your patient if you don't have them in ketosis.
Interesting.
Ketone bodies directly target KRAS. Far better than any pharmaceutical we have on the market for this.
No way.
Yeah.
That's so interesting.
So things like that. And another thing that targets KRAS is high dose IVC. So if I have a KRAS mutated patient, I'm like, you're doing high dose IVC and you're doing therapeutic ketosis. There it is. And it doesn't even matter how we get them into ketosis. That's what's cool. At that point, we can kind of like, if maybe they're prostate cancer or we have other findings, maybe they have, I don't know, like a MEK target as well. Maybe I won't use a high fat maybe I'm just using time restricted eating and fasting to get them into ketosis. So again, knowledge is power. We can know their epigenetics, what they were born with. We can know the tumor genetics, what they're expressing in that moment. We can look at their overall metabolic health and how that's playing into the equation. We can look at their likes, their dislikes. We can look at their access to quality food. We can look at the cook. Do they have to order in? Like, then we come up with a very individualized toolbox of how they nourish themselves and the timing of it. And so I think that's where we've gone rogue is that everyone's like, just eat this way. Guess what? Vegan patients die all the time too. carnivore diets, all that. Like, I mean, we're all going to get there eventually. But there are certain cancer types that will thrive much better in high fat, low carb ketosis, others that will do better in time restricted, fasted ketosis, some that just need to potentiate therapies with exogenous, like around radiation or hyperbaric oxygen. Like, we can kind of bump at it. This is what's exciting to me. And then we can get further into other restrictions like methionine restriction discussions or arginine restriction or cysteine restriction or glutamine restriction. Those tend to need off-label drugs to really change the chemistry. And you don't ever keep patients in long-term of any of those, or the patient will die. Because you need glutamine.
You need that stuff.
Exactly. Yeah. You don't have an immune system if you have no glutamine, right?
Yeah. So interesting.
We are doing all this study to like push like, oh, you need a glutamine blocking drug. Patients die from those very easily. Right? Because these drugs will block the very life force amino acid required for your healthy cells and required for your immune system to function. And we should know, hopefully we know by now, that cancer will win if the immune system is not on track.
Yeah.
So these are the conversations I wish we, in our world out there, we have a lot of influencers in the cancer space who are like, you have to do it vegan. You have to do it carnivore. You have to do it therapeutic, high fat, low carb ketosis. I'm like, you got to do it the way you got to do it.
Well, that's it. Like, you got to know thyself. Like, this is the path, right? Yes. The path is to turn inwards and to lean into your situation. And it's the metabolic terrain, but it's the individual metabolic terrain. It's that personalized piece. It's so fascinating to me. But you said something about metabolic flexibility, which I think, and this is the question really, it's this framework of metabolic flexibility, I believe, you're going to tell us, it's the ultimate map to longevity and health span and really kind of nipping a lot of chronic diseases in the bud. Do you want to speak to that? Because I mean, it can, metabolic flexibility sets you up. Should you actually get a cancer, it's a whole lot easier for people to toggle back and forth in and out of keto, right? But so many of us, and I include myself in that, because my tendencies genetically are to be insulin resistant, and my current course of action is making me even more so, which is temporary, but nevertheless, let's talk a little bit about this metabolic flexibility as a path, not just when the shit hits the fan and we end up with a cancer, but as a path to this longevity and health span, and start to nuance away from everybody needs to be keto and everybody needs, let's stop the fighting and let's get down to what really matters.
I love this. And so, you know, my life is a really good example. Like, my story at 19, the thing I did at that time, because it's the only information out there, was I went vegan. And because I had been a latchkey kid living on fast food and working at Hot Dog on a Stick from age 12 to 18, where that's where I got my square meals several times a week, my body was only accustomed to ultra processed food, really poor quality food, really cheap food, and really on the go food. Lots of like hamburger helper and, you know, like that's what my body had nourished itself on.
Well, my mom, what it built on. Yeah.
For all of junior high, every single day, I had a dill pickle, which was not one of the raw ones, with a chocolate milkshake every single day through junior high. Right. Just like, there was no nourishment. And so I went from one frying pan into another when I went on a vegan diet, because a vegan in Colorado at that time in the early 90s meant Velveeta cheese, because it's not really dairy, or like a cheese like whiz type of thing, not a gross, because I still wanted my cheesy flavor. A lot of bread, a lot of bread, vegan breads, and a lot of just vegetables. But I was so protein malnourished. Like, I can think about that now. And then I went harder as I was still not getting well. I went raw food vegan for several years. And oh my gosh. And then basically in medical school, my first year, a Chinese medicine doctor took one look at my pulse and my tongue and was like, girl. And he basically forced me to eat an egg. It was like having the lights come on. So then I was vegetarian for like the next 10, which was a huge step up. Like, suddenly my body could eat an egg and feel pretty fabulous. And then I couldn't do dairy. I was very lactose intolerant. So I would try it and it would just backfire. 2009, even though I used fasting was the only reason I was surviving. is fasting was something I employed regularly throughout. In 2009, my husband and I did a going away party to gluten because I learned that I knew I had problems with it. So we went to Europe to visit his sister and pretty much ate our way through Italy, France, and Ireland.
Yowza.
He gained 25 pounds. I gained 20 pounds. We could barely walk. We were so inflamed. We were in so much pain. It was so freaking worth it.
Also, you had to buy new clothes. Oh, or just wear the stretchy ones.
We were like sausages getting back on the plane to come home. And it was our goodbye party. We both went hardcore keto, pulled all grains. And I lost 45 pounds in like 3 months and felt like unbelievable. Like I felt like I was on fire. And my husband, who'd been dealing with bipolar disorder, and his whole family, suddenly his brain was on again, like working. Mm. Like for him, body composition was least of his issues because he'd been a triathlete the whole bit, but his brain came back online. It was so illuminating for us. And so we changed our knowledge. But then I went through menopause a couple years ago. And even though it's hard for me to go, like, it's hard for me to go out of ketosis. Like, I can wake up after not eating for 12, 13 hours and have ketones in my urine and low ketones on a blood monitor because I'm just that metabolically flexible that my body just remembers and goes there. But I now need a little different, like, I know that I could get by with a little bit more fruit now or more, I crave beans, things I haven't craved in 20 some years. I crave, maybe it's because I live in Mexico, I crave, you know, rice on occasion with some sushi. Like it's funny. And the crazy thing is wearing a constant, continuous glucose monitor and whatnot, my blood sugar barely blips. Because of that flexibility I created, my body is like, we need this now at this phase of your life. You need more of this. And my feedback is HRV and CGMs and ketone monitors on occasion. I don't use it very much anymore. And I can tell like what works and doesn't work in my body.
Wow.
Really easily. But that's a years and years of knowing and honing this. But I went through, I've tried every diet you can imagine, learning and applying it to myself and watching the trends come and go. And what matters, like Matt, you mentioned it, like your tendencies to diabetes, like my husband, he would love to be a carnivore. He is like hunter gatherer in his brain. His SNPs show that he absolutely cannot get too much protein. It drives mTOR in the biggest way for him, creates major insulin resistance, pushes him totally out of ketosis, pushes his glucose levels sky high, overdoes it. Right. And he's got a narrow window that also, if he like eats a half a cup of raspberries, same thing. He has a very narrow window. Now, baby of 10, half the siblings are diabetic and obese. Half the siblings have had cancer. The parents both died of cancer and diabetes. You know, brother died of complications from diabetes, all the others, like he knows his wind, his
it's
narrow.
Built in. Yeah.
Built in. For me, I could sit and eat a pint of raspberries. They don't do anything to my blood sugar. I would love to be a vegetarian. I crave more that lifestyle, but I have to top off with red meat. My ferritin level will not get out into the teens without it. And so there are just things I have higher protein needs than my husband. And I spent the first 30 years, 35 years of my life severely protein deficient.
But you're paying back. Your body's like, sis, this is still payback time. We're not done with it yet.
And when I hit menopause, it was like, now really payback time. Because it was like pretty, I got into a smooth, smooth place. No other real symptoms of menopause outside of just knowing I have different needs to nourish my body and to stay resilient than I did a few years ago. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the piece here is we have to just be, I was definitely that dogmatic vegan. And then I was the dogmatic vegetarian. And then when I got to ketosis, because it worked so well for me, I went through a phase of dogmatic, but then I got to the phase of fuck that. It's like, what matters in this moment for this person? Mm-hmm. That's when I became the flexibility person.
Yeah.
And that's the message that I want to make sure continues that, you know, the next book or the next iteration coming out, I'm going to make sure I've scrubbed away that I'm the keto queen because that's not what I am. And that's what, just because it really helped me or other people in certain places. think we lose the message if we try to make everything absolute.
Yeah. Well, I think that's where we get it wrong, right? Yeah. Metabolic flexibility is paves the road to longevity. And I don't care where you skew, right? Like for me, saturated fat, as a Mediterranean person, 100%, sat fat drives up inflammation in my body. I would love to be carnivore.
Yeah.
Although, you know, I can also think my way out of that if I get emotional.
Right. Today I'll be carnivore. Yeah.
Yeah. But Lord knows I've tried.
Yeah. I know. Yeah.
But I need my veggies and my beans. I just got to, you know, the bean thing's interesting because it speaks to the microbiome. And all these people, like we haven't talked, we're not going to get a chance. I'm serious. We're going to need a part two. And I don't want to get too granular on the diet. I think the takeaway from the diet is metabolic flexibility and personalized.
Yeah.
And we can just leave it at that.
I love
it. Personalized for you, your genetics, and the time of life and stage that you're at.
Yes.
So here's another idea that I think is really important to explore a little bit. And this is this whole, the tension between prevention and fear-based hypervigilance.
Ooh, that's a good one, girl.
Yeah. And because we have people walking around in abject fear, totally. Abject terror, and yet you get the other side of the equation going, I'm fine. I'm just going to have a bottle of wine every night. I'm good. And like all you stressed out people, you're the ones who are going down. And they're not all wrong, but the bottle of wine thing might be a little too far. So, you know, how do you help people to kind of navigate that that line, which doesn't need to be too narrow? It just depends maybe on a person's own experience.
Well, I mean, first I do a deep dive and sort of an evaluation of how they experience the world in, on, and around them. That helps me understand how they calibrate. You know, so if I have a patient who's extremely hyper, like overly hypervigilant or extreme fear-based, I'm going to approach their process very differently than somebody who's like, bring it on, I'll do it all, right? there's a person, so knowing it, like I meet them where they are, that helps as a clinician. You need to have some of that piece. But the other piece for both, because the bring it on folks can also be driving cortisol in a different way. You know, like my Uber athletes, my endurance athletes. I mean, I'll tell you, the sickest patient population I've ever served, and I cannot recover, and I'll just be really blunt, are my endurance athlete vegans. Like, there's no way I can help you.
Because they're burning the candle. It's not even both ends. It's all the ends.
Exactly. It's like a big, and I'm like, that's a tough one. Like, I've never seen one of those folks, unfortunately, survive. Like, they just can't. There's no way. And they're so addicted to the endorphins and addicted to the brain deficiency of the vegan diet that's got so many malnourishing aspects to it that there's no rebuilding there. And they just can't even see it. There's literally not an ability to track it because the brain is so broken. And it's like, that's a tough one. But on the other side here, it's like this piece you were talking about, the longevity piece, the mitochondria piece, like this is that metabolic flexibility. Again, it's got to be flexibility of mind and thought as well. Mm-hmm. And so I try to educate and empower people to know that, you know, a diagnosis like this can be frightening. Absolutely. That can be your first instinct. But how you meet that fear and how you choose to metabolize that fear and how you choose to harness that fear can make or break this experience. And so people need to know that if you are coming from a fear-based place, from whatever angle, the body can't heal in sympathetic nervous system. It just, it's literally an impossibility. And so I explain to them that they're going to have to bring somebody onto their team that is helping them meet that response in a profound way. For some people, that's therapy. For some people, that's somatic movement. For some people, that's, you know, psychedelics. For some people, that's a spiritual practice. That part I can't do for you.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm. There's no, but it has to be addressed.
Has to be addressed. And so I can appreciate, I mean, fear, short-term fear was just like short-term inflammation. It's a response. It's like, get in, get out. But we don't get out, we stay in. And that's where the problem lies. And so if you find yourself lingering in fear land far more than you anticipated, please get outside help. This is such a, and this I think is even something that Dr. Kelly Turner and I've talked about over and over, and what I hope she expands on in her next books as well, is this piece is really kind of a deal breaker. And so you're right that, there's a place of being so afraid of what you put into your body, but how about just being more curious about, try this out. And my data, my labs, my HRV, my continuous glucose monitor, they're going to help give me the guide rails. They're going to like guardrails. They're going to help me know, is this working for me? Is this not? And like our talk before this, there'll be moments when you are a hot damn mess in everything.
And that's okay.
It is.
Yeah.
Because guess what? It's a season. It's a moment. And so instead of fighting it, just be like, okay, this, what a beautiful expression. My body is telling me exactly. It's responding perfectly to this situation or this environment or this exposure. And so I know it will know how to respond to that and come back into balance. So it's this, the flexibility of the metabolic, digestive and food system needs to be applied to our nervous system and our belief systems as well.
Yeah. I love what you just brought up also. And this idea of, you know, there was the idea of war, but this idea of thanking the body, of expressing gratitude to the system, of expressing to the body, I know you're out, we're out for the same purpose here.
Yeah.
Right. This, and that is, I think, a piece also when we go through health challenges. The tendency is I've been betrayed.
Yeah.
You let me down, right? How could you do this to me? How could you leave me in this time of need?
Yeah. Kind
of and if we can change that inner narrative to, wow, thank you for bringing this to my attention. And I know that you're just trying to protect me. So how can we work together to get to the other side of this?
Yeah.
It's another mind shift.
Yeah.
That whether it's cancer or any big health challenge, I think can really be helpful to people to get them to the other side in a better way.
Beautiful.
Yeah. So like I said, we have like 10,000 other topics that we're supposed to talk about. We have 15 minutes. So talk to me about a classic case where people would say, well, the problem's the tumor here, but really it was the terrain that was the bottleneck. Is that always the case or do you think it's sometimes the case?
I've never not seen it be the case. Like it's always.
I mean, that's the whole point, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. It's not like we went to bed one night without a tumor and woke up the next day with it. No. It doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
Things accumulate over time, energies and toxins and stagnation and DNA damaging impacts happen over time. It's really rare we have them. It hits us really fast and furious. Yeah, terrain is the bottleneck.
Okay. So is there a terrain intervention that sounds almost too simple to be meaningful, but changes everything when it's done consistently? And I would say that like even before anybody, there's any trouble or even while during trouble.
Oh my gosh. I love this one. We so underestimate the power of rhythm.
Interesting.
Right. And being in the rhythm of, I mean, many of us love to be like everything, I want spontaneity and something different and da, 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 but our body actually wants some routine and rhythm.
Yeah.
And so one of the most profound things you can do is impact your light exposure. First light of the morning, last light at night.
Yeah.
It's incredible how much that will start and finish the day and send off all kinds of signaling pathways that help lay the groundwork for how your day goes and even how your night goes. And so to me, seems so utterly simplistic. And yet when you look around,
nobody's doing it.
No one's doing it. Like I'm at medical conferencing. How many of you watched the sunrise this morning?
Yeah. I mean,
or the sunset, or know what phase the moon is in, or, you know, had a perfectly blacked out room at night, or avoided getting on your screens before say 9 a.m. and after say 6 p.m. Like it's just silence.
So you're basically, you're almost speaking to the driver of circadian rhythm. Like it's circadian rhythm, but it's through the light exposure, like the right light at the right time.
Yes.
Which feeds into melatonin, which is, I mean, from what I've read and seen, potentially one of the most powerful built-in tools we have to prevent cancer.
What a great way to put that. The most powerful built-in tool. And you're right. We were co-evolved with that. You know, we have melanin in our skin that responds to the light that then produces the nutrients that are critical for a properly functioning immune system, but also properly functioning digestion and properly functioning sleep pattern. And then also leads to the production of these very important antioxidant endogenous messengers like melatonin and serotonin and dopamine and all these other pieces. You're absolutely right. And yet we collapse it. We block that flow in so many places in modern times today. We block that ability to utilize these things that we co-evolved with since the beginning of time.
Yeah, and underestimate them. So what do you say to people living like me, living in northern climates? Like I, you know, I'm going to get the benefit from my eyes in terms of the light information, but I'm not going to get that melanin stimulation. Like I'm at the point now where I've virtually blocked out all the naysayers on melatonin. I'm using an herbal melatonin every night. There's some really cool data on it. I'm going to have to share some information with you on that. It's called Herbatonin. And so it's a plant derived melatonin. And it's so interesting because it's like a whole food.
Oh, I love it.
You need way less for much bigger impact.
Ooh, I'm super intrigued. Ooh, I can't wait. I'm going to go down that rabbit hole later.
Oh, it's super cool. And it's also incredible. One of the most affordable supplements you'll ever buy.
See, this is what it's also, I think what you're speaking to as well, also what is accessible by all of us.
Yeah.
That or most of us anyway. Require a high, you know, bank account to get these hacks. It's huge.
Yeah.
Super interesting. You know, let's go back to that melatonin thing for just a moment because people, there's so many people saying, oh, you should never supplement that we block our endogenous. I mean, have you followed the work of Dr., you know, Russell Reiter, who's now into his 90s, who is like the father of melatonin, and this very interesting woman by the name of Doris Lowe.
Doris Lowe.
Working fantastic in this realm. We have used high dose melatonin as a way to protect our astronauts going in and out of the extreme exposures of ionizing radiation into orbit and back home, and using upwards of 7 grams a day.
Safe,
that is helping prevent that DNA denaturing that happens going up and out. As we all age, naturally our melatonin levels drop, and we don't replace our endogenous production of melatonin when we supplement. We literally supplement. We don't replace it. So I think that's just an issue. I love that you brought that up because I'm sure people are like, well, I've heard that if you take it, you'll stop your own production. That does not happen.
Well, it stops on its own. I mean, frankly, it shuts down on its own. Never mind all the shitty lifestyle habits that we have that shut it down as well. Right. So, you know, to me, it's that conversation is just silly. I say that with love, but to me, it's part of a fulsome hormone replenishment strategy.
I got chills.
We're going to replenish for those of us who can. We're going to replenish our sex hormones. Yeah. We may have to, you know, there's a replenishment of some of these hormones that we lose that we need for vitality.
And it's amazing to me, melatonin, we use melatonin in the cancer space to act as a natural aromatase inhibitor. We use melatonin in the oncology space to act as a natural selective estrogen receptor modifier. Mm-hmm. So it's those are the hardcore drugs that we use today to, you know, be endocrine therapy blockade of hormones, but they're like turning off a switch. That is not what the body needs. The body needs modulation.
Yes.
And melatonin modulates that process. It's like, you got too much happening over here, we'll bring that down. You got too little happening over here, we'll bring that up. It is a brilliant adaptogen to our hormonal physiology, hormonal signaling pathways. So I do think it's maybe underutilized in being maybe a first starting point versus bringing in other replacement therapies.
Yeah.
You might start with a modulating therapy and see if that makes a difference.
For sure. And as you said, the first step is the right light at the right time.
Yes.
And that's free. That's just walking out the door. Okay. So a couple more questions before we finish off part one of this interview. I'm just putting it out there. Now, if you could design an annual checkup for longevity enthusiasts, what would you add or remove?
Mm.
What would it include that people don't really think about right now?
Well, let's go with like the gold. If you have the resources, I would love to look at some non-contrast dye, non-radiation imaging. Yeah. Maybe done every 1 or 2 years. So various companies on the market now, Corviva, Prenuvo, you know, a few others out there. Those can be really helpful to look under the hood and capture things that are maybe quietly brewing that you're not aware of, and to monitor things if you do have something that needs to have some attention. The other thing would be your single nucleotide polymorphisms. If people don't already have those run, please do, because they tell me why you might respond to a diet or a lifestyle or a supplement in one way where somebody else will respond another. It's, you mentioned it earlier, kind of this pharmacogenomics. It tells me, are you a candidate for metformin or not? Yeah. Are you a candidate for, you know, eating a high grain diet or not? It tells me what is best for your blueprint. So that's a really foundational one. And a couple hundred dollars investment, that doesn't change over your lifetime. So unless you get like a bone marrow transplant, but there you go. And then the fundamental labs that I ran in my patients for the entire 17 years I had a private practice, and then I run in every single person I work with now, tells me a huge story, which is a CBC with differential. Mm-hmm. That tells me everything I need to know about your immune system, including the prognosis of your longevity, based on your neutrophil to lymphocyte ratio. We could do an entire discussion on that. The second one is a CMP, complete metabolic panel, which looks at just the basic organ functions and electrolyte balance. Basically, how's your electrical system and organ system functioning? Mm-hmm. Number three, a C-reactive protein, preferably high, a quantitative, is all I need. Anything above 1 or 0.1, depending on the range, is a problem in the system. And so we want it to be very, like, if you've got it higher than that, even 1.1, I want you to explore why. The other one is a sed rate. If that's above 10, that tells me you've got some problems with how your blood, how your cells are moving through the fluids of your body. So it tells me things are thick and sticky or are moving smoothly. And if it's elevated above 10, that suggests autoimmune patterns. So some self-attack stuff. And then the third one of that component, we call this the trifecta, is the LDH, lactase dehydrogenase, which used to be part of every comprehensive metabolic profile until some person behind a desk in the insurance model 10 or about 15, 20 years ago said, no more. But I will tell you, your lactase dehydrogenase is your best marker for mitochondrial function out there.
Okay.
And this will also tell me, you can also get the isoenzymes for that, which will tell us exactly where tissues are having difficulties or where they're thriving. So that's very helpful. And then I always like to look at a vitamin D level. I like to look at a ferritin level and a homocysteine level. Those tell me pretty much like, how are you methylating? How are you oxygenating? How are you detoxifying? I might throw in a GGT and a RBC magnesium. Those tell me, those like give me the most information as far as systems in your body. Now that would be like the fundamentals. And I did that with every patient for decades, which showed me so many things. We headed off so many things at the pass with that information alone. You might, if you want to throw in a thyroid panel, right?
Sure.
If you have a little extra change in your pocket, I would love, I like to look at an organic acids profile.
Nice. Yeah.
I really love, I've probably tried them all, you know, out there. The one I'm currently, I don't know if I'm allowed to say names of companies.
Yeah, no, you can talk about the ones you love. So, yep.
KBMO has one that they just launched this year. Actually, I should say the end of 2025. I was actually one of the first people who had it done. And part of that was they were in responding to my husband and I, who's the mad biochemist. We were always a little underwhelmed by the other ones out there, but we made do.
Yeah.
Well, KBMO seemed to take that to heart and create a response. And again, I get nothing in having this conversation, but I really like it. So for me, like I just did mine recently, given how much my body's been through this past year, being on an airplane all the time, lots and lots of stress, probably over like beyond anything I have endured in a long period of time, I was a little worried of what I was going to find on that. And what I was really shocked by is that my mitochondrial function, despite everything coming at it, it's like I've got Wonder Woman bracelets. I've worked so hard for so long on my metabolic flexibility that I can handle the extreme stress right now. Now, for how long? That remains to be seen. But at least I was showing, my body was giving me the feedback going, it sucks, but we're holding our own right now, girl. So just do you and we'll get back to this. Fascinating, because it shows you, like, I learned I had some dysbiosis patterns. So I was like, oh, that's interesting. I learned that I probably had some mold exposures that I was sort of suspecting, but it showed up in my oat. It helped me understand a few elements kind of functionally that might be a blind spot for me. So I will be repeating that again. I did it in October and I'll do it again in April. So just to kind of look at those things, I think that's a really powerful one. So for me, SNPs, imaging, those basic labs I just walked you through, and an OAT test, I think on an annual basis will give us a lot of information if you've got the resources to do that. But even if you don't, seriously, a CBC with differential, a CMP.
That's a basic blood work.
You get it. And those are like out of pocket, direct to consumer. For my panels, we would do a CBC with differential, a CMP, a C-reactive protein, cetirate, and LDH for less than $25.
Wow,
so
that's amazing.
That is like, that's a couple copies, you know, like, come on, that's so worth it. And it tells you so much data about yourself.
Okay. So a couple of quick fire questions before we finish. And then I think we're going to leave it at that for today. So you're involved in building a model that includes metabolic research and earlier detection tools. What does early detection really mean to you beyond the scan? So like, are there some little things that people could watch out for a little night? I mean, you know, the blood work for one, neutrophils to lymphocyte ratio, but.
Yeah. Well, I think that's just it. Like some of those labs we just discussed are super early warning signals, but another early warning signal are some simple things like just how refreshed are you after a good night's sleep? That's a big one. If you do use a continuous glucose monitor, like, is it stable or is it bouncing all over the place? So stability is key.
Yeah.
Some of the basics, like your waist to hip ratio, is that waist getting a little over the belt? You know, like that's a clue of things not right. That's actually an internal system, messaging system versus the external messaging system, even more important. And then some simple things, like I call them my nutritional physical exams. Again, like feel the back of your arms. If you have those little chicken, those little bumps, call those chicken arms. That's a classic vitamin A deficiency and fatty acid deficiency.
Oh, interesting. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So especially if people say, oh, I have night blindness or floaters, that's a really classic vitamin A deficiency.
Interesting.
I know. You're like, do, right? Cracks on the heels. Cracks on the heels can show some collagen issues, but it can also be very significant of
thyroid,
fatty acids, right?
And thyroid too, right?
Yeah, exactly. Even more interesting, if you've ever done a little reflex hammer in the back of your heel, that used to be our way of testing the thyroid.
It makes total sense. That's right? So interesting.
So funny? You just sounds like, what? And so if it rickets back really fast, you could be hyperthyroid. If it goes hypo or what? Not responsive at all, you're in trouble, right?
Yeah.
So those are some cool ones. And then things like, now most women today and even men cover their nails. So you don't see the stories there, but your fingernails, man, are a roadmap to what's going on inside of you. So I'm really trying to encourage people to let their au naturel come through. Because if you're dilapidating, for instance, we don't know if you've got weird hair growth in places that are trying to tell us something, right? So, or if you're covering up your nails and you're missing those white spots, which are the classic zinc deficiency spots, or if you're, I don't know, like using hair extensions and don't realize that you're losing a lot more hair right now than you have been. Like these are the things that we have so many ways to overcome our, you know, our physical attributions that we actually might be blocking really important feedback to the system. And so I'm always telling people, like, if you didn't have the nails or the hair or the whatevers, what might we see under the hood? And that helps people get a sense of their nutritional status and their response to their environment status.
Yeah, you know, that brings to mind when I went to school to study nutrition, there was I can't remember the guy's name, but there was this, like, I don't know, 12-page questionnaire that I used to use with clients coming out of there called symptomatology. And it felt like, and people got really annoyed at it because it felt to them like you were asking the same questions, but in different ways throughout. And they felt like you were kind of trying to trick them. But by the time you came out of that questionnaire, just through symptomatology, things that you're talking about there, it would give us an idea of where to start. Was it a digestion thing? Could it be adrenals? Could it be thyroid? Was it immune? And that is kind of the art of medicine that I think has gotten lost as we've become more sophisticated in testing and all that stuff. And physicians, to be fair to them, have lost the ability to spend time with patients. So they don't have the time. Right. But I think if we went back into the 30s or the 40s or even before, the doctor would sit with the patient and ask like a million questions. It would be an hour.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's so interesting. And you can do that on yourself. Like, I think that's fabulous. Okay. What's the research question you most want answered in the next 5 years, Dr. Nasha?
Oh my gosh, that's so good, because the brain of mine is constant in this world.
There'll be more, but you can just pick one.
There you go. I wish that they would do more. It's not even so much about the research question. It's about how we do research. That's what I'd like to see. When we have what is known as a 17-year gap in research, takes an average of from the bench to the bedside, we're a lot of people are harmed or dead by the time that comes to, you know,
17 years is a long time. Yeah.
So there's an idea of real-time research. So in the moment of things that we have, like, maybe anecdotally seen do very good things versus stuff that we like have never tried this before at all. Right.
Yeah.
About doing both. Let's get something into anecdotal real-time evaluation, collecting the data from that population. So maybe we have dozens of patients all over the country using high-dose vitamin C for cancer. Well, great. Let's keep doing the research in the RCT model on one path, but let's start collecting the data on these patients, of which we have tens of thousands of them around the country, and together make something meaningful come to light much sooner than later. So it's not even so much about what I want to see research. I think we need to just change the way we do research.
Yeah. And what's powerful about that is it takes away the obstacle of the $1 million RCTs.
Exactly.
Or a million is nothing, would be cheap. Like the multi-million dollar random controlled trials. I think that's where we bring power. And maybe, you know, as AI models become more more prevalent and better trained, we can start to merge those. That could be a superpower that we tap into.
Exactly. That, I think, is a time and a place where AI will shine in helping us make those correlations and, you know, much sooner and make this much faster to market. Yeah.
100%. Okay. What do you think will look so obvious in 10 years, but feels really controversial today? Is there anything come to mind on that?
I mean, I see in my world, I think everything I do, it seems like obvious, but it seems so weird that people are just finding out, like things like circadian rhythm or about blood sugar or metabolic flexibility. You and I know this, but the 99% of the world around us doesn't.
Yeah.
I believe that the concept of metabolic health and metabolic medicine will just be medicine.
It'll be a thing. Yeah. 100%. Foundational. Yeah. All right. Quick fire here. What's the first change that gives the biggest ROI for most people?
Sleep.
What's the one lab or metric you wish more longevity people tracked consistently?
LDH.
What's the most common self-sabotage pattern you see in high performers?
Doing too much.
Yeah, too much. You were talking about your long distance runners there. All right. Now, if someone listening here has no diagnosis, but they want to stack the odds in their favor, what's your closing message for them?
Take audit. Yeah. Take audit of your life. Take audit of everything you're putting in, on, and around you, including people, places, and things, and see what makes sense and see what no longer does.
Love. If someone listening does have a diagnosis and they're scared, what would you like them to feel after this conversation?
Empowered and hopeful.
Love. I love that. Dr. Nasha, you, my friend, are a true gift to all of us. And please let people know where they can learn more, connect with your work, find your books, find a practitioner if they need one.
Perfect. Simplest place, just go to drnasha.com, drnasha.com. There's a lot emerging in 2026 and beyond. So get in there, start splashing around as this continues to build out and emerge. But that gets you links to events and books and conversations and a soon to be launched podcast that I hope that Nat will do me the honor of being a guest on and others as we dig in. It's actually called Tend the Terrain. And so that's where I'd love to find y'all. Is
amazing. Thank you so much, Dr. Nasha. Always a pleasure. And folks, there will be a part two. So stay tuned, because there's so much stuff we didn't get to today. Thank you.
Thanks, love.
Hey, folks, just a quick reminder that all of the information presented in this podcast is for information purposes only. No medical advice, no diagnosing, no treatments suggested here. Before you try anything that you hear about or learn about here, make sure that you check with your medical provider.